The Honeymoon. Scully arrived in California just in time for the May 1983 Apple Management Retreat at Pajaro Dunes. Even though he had left all but one of his dark suits back in Greenwich, he was still having trouble adjusting to the casual atmosphere. In the front of the meeting room, Jobs sat on the floor in the lotus position, absent-mindedly playing with the toes of his bare feet. Scully tried to impose an agenda. He wanted to discuss how to differentiate their products, the Apple II, Apple III, Lisa, and Mac, and whether it made sense to organize the company around product lines or markets or functions. But the discussion descended into a free-for-all of random ideas, complaints, and debates. At one point, Jobs attacked the Lisa team for producing an unsuccessful product. "Well," someone shot back, "you haven't delivered the Macintosh. Why don't you wait until you get a product out before you start being critical?" Scully was astonished. At Pepsi, no one would have challenged the chairman like that. Yet here, everyone began pigpiling on Steve. It reminded him of an old joke he had heard from one of the Apple ad salesmen. "What's the difference between Apple and the Boy Scouts?" "The Boy Scouts have adult supervision." In the midst of the bickering, a small earthquake began to rumble the room. "Head for the beach," someone shouted. Everyone ran through the door to the water. Then someone else shouted that the previous earthquake had produced a tidal wave, so they all turned and ran the other way. The indecision, the contradictory advice, the specter of natural disaster only foreshadowed what was to come, Scully later wrote. One Saturday morning, Jobs invited Scully and his wife, Lizzie, over for breakfast. He was then living in a nice but unexceptional Tudor-style home in Los Gatos with his girlfriend, Barbara Jasinski, a smart and reserved beauty who worked for Regis McKenna. Lizzie had brought a pan and made vegetarian omelets. Jobs had edged away from his strict vegan diet for the time being. "I'm sorry I don't have much furniture," Jobs apologized. "I just haven't gotten around to it." It was one of his enduring quirks, his exacting standards of craftsmanship combined with a Spartan streak made him reluctant to buy any furnishings that he wasn't passionate about. He had a Tiffany lamp, an antique dining table, and a laser disc video attached to a Sony Trinitron, but foam cushions on the floor rather than sofas and chairs. Scully smiled and mistakenly thought that it was similar to his own frantic and Spartan life in a cluttered New York City apartment early in his own career. Jobs confided in Scully that he believed he would die young, and therefore he needed to accomplish things quickly so that he would make his mark on Silicon Valley history. "We all have a short period of time on this earth," he told the Scullies as they sat around the table that morning. "We probably only have the opportunity to do a few things really great, and do them well. None of us has any idea how long we're going to be here, nor do I. But my feeling is I've got to accomplish a lot of these things while I'm young." Jobs and Scully would talk dozens of times a day in the early months of their relationship. "Steve and I became soulmates, near constant companions," Scully said. "We tended to speak in half sentences and phrases." Jobs flattered Scully. When he dropped by to hash something out, he would say something like, "You're the only one who will understand." They would tell each other repeatedly, indeed so often that it should have been worrying, how happy they were to be with each other and working in tandem. And at every opportunity, Scully would find similarities with Jobs and point them out. "We could complete each other's sentences because we were on the same wavelength. Steve would rouse me from sleep at 2 a.m. with a phone call to chat about an idea that suddenly crossed his mind. 'Hi, it's me,' he'd harmlessly say to the dazed listener, totally unaware of the time. I, curiously, had done the same in my Pepsi days. Steve would rip apart a presentation he had to give the next morning, throwing out slides and text. So had I, as I struggled to turn public speaking into an important management tool during my early days at Pepsi. As a young executive, I was always impatient to get things done and often felt I could do them better myself. So did Steve. Sometimes I felt as if I was watching Steve playing me in a movie. The similarities were uncanny, and they were behind the amazing symbiosis we developed. This was self-delusion, and it was a recipe for disaster. Jobs began to sense it early on. We had different ways of looking at the world, different views on people, different values, Jobs recalled. I began to realize this a few months after he arrived. He didn't learn things very quickly, and the people he wanted to promote were usually bozos. Yet Jobs knew that he could manipulate Scully by encouraging his belief that they were so alike, and the more he manipulated Scully, the more contemptuous of him he became. Canny observers in the Mac group, such as Joanna Hoffman, soon realized what was happening and knew that it would make the inevitable breakup more explosive. Steve made Scully feel like he was exceptional, she said. Scully had never felt that. Scully became infatuated because Steve projected on him a whole bunch of attributes that he didn't really have. When it became clear that Scully didn't match all of these projections, Steve's distortion of reality had created an explosive situation. The ardor eventually began to cool on Scully's side as well. Part of his weakness in trying to manage a dysfunctional company was his desire to please other people, one of many traits that he did not share with Jobs. He was a polite person. This caused him to recoil at Jobs's rudeness to their fellow workers. We would go to the Mac building at 11 at night, he recalled, and they would bring him code to show. In some cases, he wouldn't even look at it. He would just take it and throw it back at them. I'd say, "How can you turn it down?" And he would say, "I know they can do better." Scully tried to coach him. "You've got to learn to hold things back," he told him at one point. Jobs would agree, but it was not in his nature to filter his feelings through a gauze. Scully began to believe that Jobs's mercurial personality and erratic treatment of people were rooted deep in his psychological makeup, perhaps the reflection of a mild bipolarity. There were big mood swings. Sometimes he would be ecstatic, at other times he was depressed. At times he would launch into brutal tirades without warning, and Scully would have to calm him down. 20 minutes later, I would get another call and be told to come over because Steve is losing it again, he said. Their first substantive disagreement was over how to price the Macintosh. It had been conceived as a $1,000 machine, but Jobs's design changes had pushed up the cost so that the plan was to sell it at $1,995. However, when Jobs and Scully began making plans for a huge launch and marketing push, Scully decided that they needed to charge $500 more. To him, the marketing costs were like any other production cost and needed to be factored into the price. Jobs resisted furiously. "It will destroy everything we stand for," he said. "I want to make this a revolution, not an effort to squeeze out profits." Scully said it was a simple choice. He could have the $1,995 price, or he could have the marketing budget for a big launch, but not both. "You're not going to like this," Jobs told Hertzfeld and the other engineers, "but Scully is insisting that we charge $2,495 for the Mac instead of $1,995. Indeed, the engineers were horrified. Hertzfeld pointed out that they were designing the Mac for people like themselves, and overpricing it would be a betrayal of what they stood for. So Jobs promised them, "Don't worry, I'm not going to let him get away with it." But in the end, Scully prevailed. Even 25 years later, Jobs seethed when recalling the decision. "It's the main reason the Macintosh sales slowed and Microsoft got to dominate the market." The decision made him feel that he was losing control of his product and company. And that was as dangerous as making a tiger feel cornered.